and welcome to Crew Call, the Below the Line podcast by, for, and about the crew. Today's guest is Ryan Murphy. No, not that Ryan Murphy. Our guest is a line producer. Welcome, Ryan Murphy. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. So I'm excited about this one because you're going to talk to us more about stuff that people don't even really know about the funding and the money and the budget and where it all comes from and how you get it and how things work. So that's going to be a nice little different, subject for us today. So now, Ryan, how did you get started in the business?
I got started almost 10 years ago. I'm from Providence, Rhode Island. And back then, there was a lot of the film tax credit starting to pop up. So when everybody was moving to New York and Hollywood, I was kind of fine where I was. There was a producer director who was from there, and he moved back from New York to work in Rhode Island because the tax credits were so strong. Mm. So I hunted him down at a bar one night as he was giving a speech. And I said, I live here. I'm more than happy to do anything I need to learn every single thing that I can from you. And he said, fantastic. Pick me up tomorrow morning downtown and we'll get started.
Now, it's never been that easy for me, but that's nice to know that you could do that in some places.
Well, in our overall conversation, I think, again, that's kind of why it's a good conversation to have, because if there are people that are in, anywhere in the middle of the U.S. or even out of the country, there's such strong tax incentives, and all you hear about nowadays is how jobs are running away from L.A.
Yeah.
So before you get on a plane or get on a bus and come out to L.A., and I'm based in L.A. now, look, what's your community? Who is your film commissioner in your state? Every state has one. Who maybe is from your state? What productions are coming into your state? Start there so that way you don't get out to LA or New York, and people say, oh, do you know this guy? And you say, no. And you say, well, he's from your hometown. You really should. Cause that would have made your life a lot easier.
Right. So what was your first show with this person, or what did you do with him? What was the first thing that you did with him?
Well, he was a director producer. His name is Michael Crunty. Not to name drop, but I'll use his name because he's a great guy and he helped me out in the beginning. Mm-hmm. He was basically a writer, director, producer who's always had his eye on making the movies that he wanted to make. And I really envied him for that. And so he kind of brought me on to help with all the logistics and the producing side, because I told him I was very interested in knowing everything on the physical production and the production. And then there was this third guy, Tom Dinucci, who is himself out, making all his own movies now. So we kind of had this little triangle of creativity where he would dole out all the information. We would all suck it up and figure out what was going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Because there was so many productions in town, there was a show called Brotherhood for Showtime, which was a great show. So he directed a few episodes of that. So we got to work on that. And that was, then all these other productions started pouring into town. So it was we couldn't kind of keep up with everything that was going on.
How did you get into the money portion of it? Because that's what you focus on. When you started out and you were doing logistics and you were doing different things, how did you hone into that one direction?
Well, Michael always raised all his own money to make the movies he wanted to make. So he taught me from the beginning, if you want to make, a movie or you want to do a TV show, if you don't really understand and know how to control the money, then the production's going to run away from you. Mm-hmm. And if you don't really know how much money is in, is in the bank, then, you're in trouble because you really don't know how to budget things properly. So I was just always, line producers, and producers, they're easy to spot. They're the guys who always have to figure out the check at dinner and tell people how much they owe, and they're the guys stuck doing that job.
So after you were working with him, when did you go off and do other things and just fall into that position, or did you do other positions as well?
After working with him for a couple of years, other great advice was, you can only do a position for so long till you get stuck in it. Mm-hmm. So unless it's what you want to be doing. If you're an assistant, you have to have some kind of a time frame on yourself. Usually I always felt 2 years is a good mark. So another production came into town. A local UPM hired me on that job, which was a couple pilots came into town. So I actually was APOC on those, met a bunch of people from out in LA because it was pilots. So his whole team like moved in and took over the state. And then they were telling me about how wonderful it was to move to LA. So I decided to move out to LA.
And do you think it's wonderful?
Oh, I love it out here. I absolutely love it.
Okay. I'm born and raised here, so I'm like,
totally jaded. My girlfriend's from here, and we live in Santa Monica, and to her, it's just like movie trucks mean more traffic. So
exactly.
I completely get it.
So tell us about what your typical day is as a line producer.
I get a lot of different projects and a lot of different scripts from various people. I'm huge into not just networking, but really having good core relationships. So, you know, a friend might send me a script and say, I really like this, but I have no idea what the budget should be. Recently, we just finished up a kids movie for Universal. So I've been dealing with a lot of the post stuff for that. Now that's finished up. So it's really just always juggling 1,000 different projects. And then eventually one of them goes and you focus your energy there. So I'm always just kind of trying to balance a bunch of plates of what could happen next.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. I mean, the days usually go by really quickly. You get up in the morning and you start checking your email and you drive cross town for a coffee meeting or for a lunch meeting. And then by the time you get back, everybody wants something at the last minute. And then you try to get it figured out. And then nobody cares about it tomorrow anyway. So it's a good time.
So now I know that we discussed that a lot of people aren't really, they really don't know where the money is coming from and they're not quite sure how it all happens. So what can you like explain to our listeners about how a movie is made and how you get the funding for it and where the money comes from and how it's allocated and budgeted for every part of making that movie?
The one thing to think of is, you know, the industry, it feels like, you know, that when it feels like jobs are going away or shrinking, it's because, you know, the homemade creativity of I want to be a filmmaker is always there. And people always feel like they want to have a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So technology kind of tries to catch up to that. So instead of now having to go buy raw stock of 35mm, you know, you can just go rent a Red camera. But because of that, there are less jobs at like camera houses and there are less jobs at, you know, post houses because the workflow is easier. So as a result, though, budgets get smaller.
Okay.
So everyone's always thinking, well, how can I make this movie? How can I make this movie? Everybody wants more money. And I don't mean everybody wants more money like the, you know, the fat producer in Beverly Hills smoking on a cigar, you know, like, oh, I'm going to take all the money and leave like 2 cents for the film. That's not what it is.
Okay.
I mean, yes, there are people that are like that, but for the most part, everybody wants to make the best movie possible.
Mm-hmm.
So you look at, you know, just use like a horror film as a really easy project. A $1 million horror genre film is the one thing that always seems to sell. So that's the one thing people always try to make.
Okay.
So if you say, well, what's worked in the past, you know, the found footage or the, you know, like the torture porn, like Saw or the paranormal, you take a movie and say, well, you know, Jason Blum or Roy Lee or these guys can make these movies for a really low budget, and the movie's a really good quality, so it can be released in the theaters with low overhead and make its money back. So everybody tries to reverse engineer that. So basically it's, let's figure out how to make a movie for the least amount of money possible. You know, the every filmmaker wants their movie to be on the big screen, where nowadays less people are interested in going to the movies to see anything other than a big tentpole movie, unfortunately.
Right.
If that wasn't true, you know, there'd be more art houses. You know, everybody, it's crazy. I live in Santa Monica and we used to have, it's being renovated now, but you know, there's a great art house theater where you could pay, you know, $6 for a movie, or you could go across the street and pay like 15 for a 3D movie and people would still flock to the 3D movie. So what the producers try to do is they say, okay, how can we make a film that's going to cost the least amount of money to make so that we have a shot of getting distribution? And to give the best broad strokes, there's two channels. There's the international side and the domestic side. So if you make a movie with a lot of international appeal and a lot of domestic appeal, say, you know, an actress that seems to be familiar looking, then you have a shot of that movie going to make, you know, three or four times what the budget was, either in the theater or on a Netflix deal or in Redbox. So then the investors will make their money back, the producers will get their fees, and the distributors will be happy. So I guess in a nutshell, just putting or trying to wrap your head around how to properly pick a project always depends on the elements of once it's made, you know, will people not just go see it, you know, but will anyone want to distribute it? Because all too often people make, you know, films and TV shows or pilots that nobody has an interest in seeing. And that's really the groundwork.
So do you think some of the budgeting comes from getting these actors that would draw the crowd and the money goes to them?
Absolutely. So like, let's just say as an example, we're going to do a $1 million film. You know, you want to have a script that's good enough that it's not just a cheesy slasher film, that you can maybe attract a piece of talent, whether either it's cast or the filmmaker, to say, we're going to give you this much money, and you're going to be able to go away for 3 or 4 weeks and make a good enough movie that you'll feel comfortable with it, you'll be proud of. And, you know, the investment size, say it's $1 million or $2 million, there's not a lot of risk. So that our investors, when we go to them, they're going to be interested in, you know, investing again someday. Or if it's a studio, you know, they're not just throwing money away where they could have spent it on, you know, gave more money to one of the TV series or something else.
Another question about that is, how do you, when you're talking about the money, how do you decide how much the budget's going to be? Is that strictly from like the investor's side of it, or?
Well, you know, you can always, so for instance, you could take a film and name that film, and again, we'll just stick with it with like $1 million horror film, and say, okay, I have this type of a film with this piece of cast in it. You know, what should this movie be? You can take it to a sales agent, and basically sales agents will take the project and say, I can sell this project in this place in the world for this amount of money. So like a horror genre film with, let's just say, Miley Cyrus in it is worth this amount of money. Mm-hmm. So you take, you know, you go around the room and you figure out how much money a movie could be worth, and you kind of back into that number. So the old days, you know, you might just say, oh, we'll make this movie for $5 million. And then all of a sudden, you know, you can't recoup any of your investors' money because nobody's interested in paying $5 million for this movie that you just made.
So I guess that's where it becomes the tricky part, is agreeing on the amount and trying to find the investors, and then working within that budget, still having the actors that you want to pull the viewing, but still make a great movie with having the people that you need to make the movie.
Correct. Yes. So, I mean, everybody is always looking for, you know, investors that want to invest in their film, and that's really wonderful. But, you know, all too often, you can't just throw $2 million in a bank account and hope that, you know, you make a good movie and you throw it out there in the world and that it sells. Mm-hmm. Actually, a really great story, without naming any names. Mm-hmm. If you're in LA, there's a market here called AFM, and it happens every year. Okay. Where international sales agents come from all over the world, and they bid on whatever movies that have been made the previous year or years before. So let's say we made this $1 million genre film and we're trying to sell it at AFM. Different buyers from different parts of the world will come and say, this movie is worth this to me or worth that to me, or I'll buy this movie from you if, you know, you rescore it or translate it into Spanish or something else. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you know, people have figured out when it's too late that they may have made a film that nobody wants to see. Mm. So as an example, a few years back, there was a panel, and panels are great to go to because there's just a wealth of knowledge there. A filmmaker got up and said, hey, you know, I just spent $3 million of my parents' money to make my film, and nobody wants to buy it from me.
Oof.
So, you know, the panel kind of, whoa, well, we're used to hearing that. We hear that quite a bit. And everybody kind of had a little laugh, and even the guy was laughing. What do I do now? And they said, well, you know, who directed the film? And he said, well, I did. I said, okay, well, have you directed anything else? And he said, no, but everybody really liked my stuff in film school. And okay. And they said, well, who was the lead? And, you know, my friend from film school. So there was, you know, they just took $3 million, made a film, and prayed that someone would like it so much that they would want to buy it. And that didn't happen. Now, luckily it was this guy's family. Well, I guess luckily, cause it was his family's money, but you know, when you find an investor, the independent film world is so difficult. You happen to find one who's interested in doing that, and they put up any amount of money, and then all of a sudden, you know, you can't even get someone to take a look at it. That's a pretty scary thought. Nowadays, there's Netflix and there's iTunes, so there are channels to get it out there, which helped a little bit, but nothing like it used to be.
I would think that someone, if they had that kind of money, I would think that they would want to just write the script or write the story and then see if someone would want to be in it. You know what I mean? $3 million. I mean, they could get a pretty good actor, I would think, to do it if they liked it, you know, before they went ahead and shot it with a nobody.
That's the scary thing. Again, you would think, but a lot of people, you know, and I never take anything away from artists because it's so important, but a lot of people just feel like, hey, I want to make this and I have the money to make it. And I'm just going to go do it. And he had the opportunity to do that. I to this day, don't know what had happened to the project. Right. I think that one of the DVD agents or somebody may have bought it from him for a small price, but that's the risk that comes around.
I wonder if he would have done like a little short of it and spent just part of that money just to give a taste to see if someone would be interested or if he could like put it out on the internet and see if people, like if he got a lot of hits on it, then go forward with a full movie. Would have been the wiser.
Sometimes, you know, money can be a problem. You know, I don't want to say that there's too much money, then it's a problem, but you know, how much does it cost to make a good movie? You know, back to the earlier days, my first boss, Michael, he came from the theater world. So he looked at it as you just need a stage and actors. Everything else around you is, you know, it's all about the story and the script and how important that is. So like you said, if you have a really good script, then, you know, do we need a helicopter shot? This is things that I deal with quite a bit. You know, a writer is writing and it's a creative position, which is great to do, but he'll happen to write, you know, and then the helicopter lands and the SWAT team jumps off and they run into the building. Well, you know, the difference between the helicopter landing and, you know, maybe the cop cars pulling up or like the SWAT van, that's thousands and thousands of dollars, not to mention, you know, extras for stunts. So little things like that really get caught up in the wheels of ridiculousness.
Okay. Going back to, now we have like $1 million or $2 million, like you were saying, and you want this actor in it to draw the crowd. So you kind of have to give them X amount of dollars. And now the rest of your budget has to be divided up with all these different departments and all these different people. Have you had the problem of a certain department kind of complaining that there's not enough money to do what they need to do or not enough, you know, or you can't even pay maybe that person what they're worth? Has that ever happened? As far as like the crew, the engineers, the editors, the filmmakers?
Absolutely. You know, that's, you know, my cardinal rule is, you know, the 99% of the world's problems are due to miscommunication. And a lot of times either producers or directors, maybe they'll be embarrassed to say what they really have, or, you know, they talked about, let's just say like this helicopter shot that they wanted to get. And then it comes to, well, can we afford that? And whether it's ego or just, you know, not wanting to let something go, that could be an issue. But when you have really good people, when you have really great professionals, they'll all work together as a team because everybody wants to work. Nobody wants to be sitting home when they can be making either a TV show or a film, you know, or a YouTube video, anything. I mean, everybody, if you're in this business, it's because you want to be creative, and the great guys are into that. So for instance, that's a great question too, that you brought up. You know, on this last project that we did, you know, the VP and the grip came over and said, hey, you know, we got to try to figure out how to do this shot. And to try to do this, we have to, you know, we're on a stage, we got to rip off the ceiling and we got to bring in this and we have to do all these things and to get this angle and it'd be easier with a crane. And they said, what do you want to do? Because we don't have the money for it. And I said, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important do you think it is that we get this shot this way? Or is there another way to do it? And they said, well, we don't know. We can ask the director. So the three of us went over and we asked the director. And he said, oh, I don't care. Let's just change this up a little bit and do it this way instead. And, you know, lo and behold, what could have cost an extra $10,000, $15,000 and a half a day of prep, you know, was mm-hmm. a 20-minute fix. Because the right people, instead of coming up and screaming about it and saying, we don't have the money, or you have to get me this, or I can't make the day, or I don't want to be embarrassed in front of the director, they were just up front and they just said how it was. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference. Professionals want to make it work. And the really good ones, I mean, I've seen guys, you know, take a golf cart and you know, a coconut and make a piano. And it's just amazing. You know, why? Because they're into their job and they like to have a good time. And as long as you're upfront and honest and say, look, I'm sorry, we don't have the cash for this. And that brings up, if I start ranting, just reel me back in, but that brings up another issue. There's this thing that's been going on since the dawn of filmmaking, or probably anything artistic, where, you know, a money person sits across the table from the creative person, whether that's the cinematographer or the director or, you know, the wardrobe person, and says, this is how much money I have for you and your department. Mm-hmm. And that other person, that creative person thinks they probably have an extra 20-30% of what they're telling me. Mm-hmm. And the money person may be lying. They may have more, they may have less, and there's never really a way to know. So it's that creative person's job to always be trying to do the best they can. So they say, hey, this wardrobe was going to cost, you know, $1,500. Now it's going to cost $1,700. Is that okay? And, you know, no, or yes, or there's always that weird balance and nobody knows how to really address it. Mm-hmm. I like to just say, here's your bucket of money. I don't care if you spend all of it on yourself and a dollar on wardrobe, as long as it looks great. I just want you to do it. Mm-hmm. Here's your money. But all too often people think he's got another bucket stashed somewhere. Yeah. And that's a lot of the time, that's not the case. What could happen is, you know, the camera package may have came in a little under. So now there's an extra couple $1,000s. So if something goes really wrong, here's some extra cash that was just saved somewhere else. But that doesn't, you know, then you look like a liar because you said you didn't have any more money. Now you've got a couple extra grand, but it's just the nature of the game.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that you would want to tell them lower than what you actually have so that they're a little bit more creative in the sense of, okay, I got to do this. So let's make it look like, you know, to see how creative they are to make it happen without having to spend so much money. So then you do have some money left over for them. And then if they need it, or you could give it to them for a good job done. But, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's unfortunate, but they'll just figure, if I don't spend it all, then I could have had better set dressing. I could have had, you know, instead of these heels, I could have had those heels, or I could have had a gold watch instead of a silver watch, or, you know, because right. Everybody's into getting hired on the job. And then the second you're hired, everybody's on to the next job. It's like, oh, I just heard this other movie's going to start soon. And, you know, the PA happened to, you know, mention it at the crafty table. Now everybody's working on the job as soon as this one's done that the PA happened to mention that doesn't exist in the first place.
Oh.
So that being said, everybody's, you know, always kind of interviewing for the job. You know, everybody wants to do a good job. So, you know, the production designer wants to impress the director so they can work together again. The director wants to impress the producer so they can work on the next film, mm-hmm. and so on.
Yeah. Now you were talking about there's money people and there's creative people, but do you feel like you're both creative and the money person?
I try to be, because, you know, the other thing, going back to when there is or there isn't enough money, a lot of times I think that, you know, the crew while shooting forgets how passionate usually the producers and the director is and how long they sat with the project. I mean, there's films that, you know, I've worked on for years before they finally got made. So, you know, a producer if they're into, you know, making the project, then they want the best thing they can possibly get off the page. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had it in their minds for years. Oh, she walks down, you know, the lawn of the White House and she's in a red dress with red heels and her hair is perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, once you've read that on a page for years, when you're finally there on the day and all of a sudden the actress is there and she's dressed in that red dress and heels and her hair is done, then you're just like, wow, this is coming true now.
Right.
So, you know, if they're working, you know, their asses off to make sure that they have the money to afford all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So when the, you know, I don't want to beat up on the wardrobe, but the wardrobe people come up and say, well, you know, we don't have the money for this dress. You know, believe it or not, you know, it's like twisting the knife in the, you know, the producer's heart that they're not getting everything they can out of that project.
But do they always find ways to manipulate it so that they can get what they want, or do they just have to like let go of certain things that just cannot happen?
At the end of the day, you know, things are always going to have to get let go. You know, a 110 page script usually gets chopped down closer to 100 because you look at the shoe leather that's there that you can or can't afford. And you see, okay, what can we really do without, although we don't want to? You know, the really great filmmakers, and if you look at those that always work with the same people, you know, if you think of talented filmmakers, they're the ones who are always working with these the same cast and the same crew. It's because they all have a shorthand. They say, okay, we're going to read this script, and they're going to know right off the bat, you know, this is what's going to be important, and this is what's not going to be important. So how do we make sure that, you know, there's enough money for these key things? And you know, you look at the greats, you know, like a Soderbergh, you know, he's got a team and they know what he's going to like. So, okay, let's make sure that we get this, this, and this, because those are the things that he's passionate about. So if he tells us these are the things, we'll focus our resources here or there.
Okay.
But you know, he's the guy who will pick up the camera and shoot the whole thing himself if he has to. So, you know, he's digging in. So then, you know, their people are digging in.
Now, how is your job different going from, you know, the pre-production of, like you were talking about, well, you see it, this is how you guys want to do it. You're like, you work on it like years before you even start shooting it. So how is your position different from the pre-production, then during the actual production, and then in post-production?
I'm a little OCD. I like to know everything about everything. So the second the writer finishes the script, mm-hmm. I want to read it and ask them 1,000 questions so that if there's a question that comes up, I have the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So on everything that I've been fortunate to work on, I'm there from the beginning until the bitter end.
Okay.
So if something comes up, and it's super unfortunate the way these things happen, but all of a sudden, you know, we forgot to give someone a special credit or a special thanks in the end credit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, locked picture. It's going off to print and, you know, you're remembering these little tidbit things, you know, based off of a notebook that I've had for 3 years to not forget.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to be involved in everything. And I think that's the new kind of position that's morphed over the years where they used to be creative execs.
Yeah.
Now you can kind of be either like a co-producer or like almost like a junior producer.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be involved from the beginning and see it all the way through.
Well, I could see how in the beginning, like you were saying, like you look at the script and you take notes. That, I guess, helps you form your budget and where the monies get allocated, because you'd say, like, for instance, your helicopter scene. If you see that that's something that's of real importance to the storyline, you're like, okay, well, I'm going to have that amount of money to take care of this. But then I also have this, and I want to have this guy doing the camera, and I want to have this editor over here for sound effects. So I could see now, like, when you start from the very beginning and looking at the script, you could kind of get an idea of where, how much money and where that money needs to go to, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, again, just because we brought up this really, you know, wonderful bad example of the helicopter shot.
Right.
If with nowadays, when you look at technology and you look at how far things have come, let's take a quick second and look at a creative solution to that. So we have a helicopter shot where, you know, we're looking down on a baseball field at a high school and all of a sudden this helicopter lands and then all these SWAT team members jump out. Well, what about instead if we took a GoPro helicopter and we had this high angle shot where it's POV of the helicopter, and then it comes down. And then as we're on the field, we just start seeing these boots and these guys in SWAT clothes jumping over us, running towards what we were just looking at. So now, you know, there's just a little angle, a little cheat, so that the POV was the helicopter coming down, and then you see these guys running off from behind them. So from their angle, it looked like they were just on a helicopter, and then they just ran onto the field. There's little things that creative directors, you know, that mm-hmm. really have a passion, or producers, we'll just throw that against the wall. Hey, what if we do it this way? What if we do it that way? What if it's a bus or a van instead? No, I want the helicopter shot. Well, how do we do that? You know, and if we do that, then we're not going to be able to do this underwater sequence. Then the director says, I never want to do the underwater sequence anyway. Well, great. Now we don't have to worry about that. And, you know, it's the dialogue, because again, it isn't like someone saying, no, I don't want you to do this scene. It's, we don't have the money.
It's a puzzle.
It's a big puzzle.
Yeah. You just have to figure out, looking at the puzzle, okay, we want to do this. Okay, well, we don't have the money for all three full out. So how can we make it so all three of them can be done? Okay, we'll do this one this way, this one this way. Yeah. It's more about the dialogue and the script, and then some of the shots. They don't have to do anything crazy expensive. It's just a good way of making the movie to draw someone in without having to do a ton of different things.
Absolutely.
It's on your part. You can make a great film by not having to spend tons of money on crazy stuff like that. And then talking about that, how about locations? Are locations pricey? Certain locations, or outside versus inside and that kind of stuff?
Everybody wants to, you know, if you can shoot inside, you know, ideally on a soundstage, then, you know, it's so much easier because everything's locked off as long as there's air conditioning. You know, you don't have to worry about crew members getting lost, getting to the set, or cast right. having problems. Locations can be crazy. You know, you could look at a location in California that costs, you know, the price of a new Volkswagen, or you could go to, you know, a baseball field in one place, you know, might be 10 times the price as a football field somewhere else. So picking locations, again, is very tricky, but when you have a great team and you can sit down and say, what are we going to go out looking for and how can we be really creative? That's what's so important.
Okay, now line producers are often DGA production managers as well. How about yourself?
Not me. I was in IATSE years ago. You know, if you're a UPM, you most definitely, you know, you're in the DGA. But as in terms of being a line producer on things that I've worked on, I have not joined any of the guilds. And I guess if you would ask why, I think they're all great and they're wonderful, but I've just always been focused on getting to the next thing, and I've never settled into anything.
Does it matter if you are or not?
I haven't really had to pigeonhole myself in any one specific job yet. So okay. I don't think so. I mean, I've been fortunate to work with really good people that I continue to work with, and it just hasn't been necessary. If I was out looking for work, then it would be a different story, I guess.
But this way you can keep your options open though, right?
Absolutely. And you know, there's a lot of things that you can't work on if you are a union member that you'd like to work on because of different parameters and things of that nature.
Right. No, I completely hear you on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, you don't want to join a union and then drop out because, you know, they're right. great. I mean, they protect their people and they're important to have. And they're a great resource because if you need good people, you know, you can turn to the unions to find them.
My producer is asking, have you ever been a part of the fundraising process?
Yes, I have in many different ways. And the most, I learned the easy way and the hard way. There's two different types of investors. Now there's always the studio movie who they just can come in and maybe do a negative pickup, or they like the project, so they're looking to fund it themselves. But in terms of private equity, in terms of, you know, just going out and looking for investors, okay, let's figure out how to go raise $1 million to make a movie. the two investors, there's the one type who is interested in making a movie, and they bring their checkbook to the meeting and they say, here's your cash, good luck, and I want 5 seats at the premiere, and I'm probably going to send you my daughter to be in it. Some kind of a speaking role. I don't care what it is, and you know, I'll let you know what days that I'm going to be there, and I want good food on those days. Great. And then there's the other type of investor who either really wants to be either a producer or a director or maybe an actor, or you know, they're really anal about every little cent that's being spent. And navigating through the waters of private equity is tricky because you never know what the investor will be interested in. They could sit there and listen to the pitch and listen to what you have to say, and you don't know if they're thinking, I'm going to write you a check, or why would I give you this money? And the most important thing is, if you don't know what you're asking for, you haven't put together the best possible plan, then you're just doing such an injustice to not only yourself, the project, the investor, but you know, you've just ruined this one potential investor because they're jaded that you didn't do your homework.
Now, is there anything else that you can tell us about what you do? Anything else that we haven't touched upon that maybe you feel is important for people to know about this kind of topic?
It's always just looking at what the climate is, basically in distribution and in finance, what's going on in the world. You know, who's buying this, who's buying that, what action movies are doing this year, or what superhero movies are doing, and how that plays into everything. Because it used to be, if you could take this type of a movie star and put them in this type of a movie, then you are guaranteed to sell that movie internationally for, say, $2 million. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, that just might not work. And if you're not fluent with what's going on, then there's a problem, because you're just going to get left behind with everything else. You know, you need to know, oh, well, we're going to go, if you put an example, if you're an investor and I put a film, you know, proposal in front of you and say, hey, I need $1 million. And you say, oh, but you're going to shoot this in North Carolina. And I'm saying, oh, absolutely. Then you say, well, you realize that there's no tax credit in North Carolina anymore.
Yeah,
and I say,
right.
Oh, that you're not doing your homework. You always, nowadays, everybody just needs to know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Now, as far as people that are now, after listening to you, they're interested and say, hey, I want to get involved in something like that. What do you think are good skills that they should have?
Attention to detail and initiative are everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like everything in this business, you just have to be paying attention. There are so many resources out there, and there's so many people looking to work with good people, whether mm-hmm. they're interns or PAs or producers. So if you're sitting in LA, you know, at a Starbucks for 9 hours a day, complaining about how you're not working, that's not good. You know, you should know that, you know, AFMs are on the corner, or all the film festivals that are going on. And, you know, there's plenty of classes you can take. UCLA has some great classes, even through their extension program. Paying attention to the trades and what's going on is a big help.
So do you think for something like what you do, it's more about knowing a little of everything about making a movie, or do you think it's something specific to, like, let's say, math or creative production?
I would say it's always about knowing a little bit of everything. That's always been what I've kind of focused on. That's why I never try to get pigeonholed into one specific thing, although I was a coordinator for a while. When I was working on anything that I wasn't kind of in charge of mm-hmm. or had my hands into, the first person I would make friends with is the accountant. Because if you realize that the accountant is bored on a Friday afternoon in mm-hmm. pre-production and they have nothing to do, there's no money. And I've worked on a lot of independent films and projects that if the accountant is bored, there's probably no money and everybody that's out working isn't going to get paid. So I don't like that feeling. And, you know, I want to know, okay, well, how do I make sure that this doesn't happen to me? Or what do I do to make sure that, you know, I have some kind of idea of what's going on. So it's really reaching out. It's the attitude too. I mean, it depends what you want to do. If you really want to be a cinematographer, then you should work in the camera department and the grip and lighting, because you'll start to understand all of those things and have relationships with talent and the director. If you know the job that you're passionate about, then, you know, by all means, there's no reason that you should be concerned with the bean counting that's going on in the accounting office. Mm-hmm. But if you at least have an idea of, you know, we have to try to make this day, we have to try to, you know, pull off all these shots, then you're more willing to help out with getting what we need to get done for the day. When you're just kind of irate and pissed off because second meal is pizza, then, you know, nobody's going to be happy about it, you know? Right. Nobody's happy when we're going into 14, 15 hours and, you know, the coffee's cold and, you know, life is miserable.
Now, do you ever get a chance to choose people that work below you?
Yeah. You know, usually, you know, I've been lucky, to work with the same people kind of over and over again. But there's nothing better than being able to call people that you know and that you rely on and say, hey, we're starting a show. Do you want to come work? And, you know, it's great when they can say yes. And it's not bad when they say no, because they're usually working on something else. And it's great when you see people, you know, that you've worked with over the years that are staying busy and that are working.
Now, how about if someone came up to you, a young student or a young person came up and said, did the same thing that you did. Hey, I want to learn how to do this and I want to work with you. What do you want to see in them?
Just hunger and drive. I don't care about anything else, because you could teach monkeys how to do the job. Mm-hmm. It's just, you actually, like, you know, we make movies, you know, and nowadays TV is like, what better job is this? The worst day on a film set is the best day, you know, at working at a bank.
Right.
And there's going to be ups and downs, but, you know, you got to be really hungry. And, you know, everybody's always afraid of, you know, working or who's working for free or not working for enough money. If you're motivated by money, you're in the wrong job. You're in the wrong career field. Money follows, but it's all about, you know, being able to make a movie or
right.
make a TV show. That's what it's all about. The best advice I ever got was the toe you step on today might be connected to the ass you have to kiss tomorrow. So
I love that. Well, thank you, Ryan. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. You too.
For Crew Call. If you'd like to support the podcast, remember to click the Amazon link on the Tapple website before you go shopping. It doesn't cost you anything, and Amazon gives us a little kickback. Everyone wins. And if you like what you've heard, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. Good or bad, we really appreciate the feedback. Thanks again to Ryan for the wide-ranging discussion of budgets, funding, and helicopters. Tune in next week for another great guest.